I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. People from all over the world come to the United States looking for freedom and justice. Some are fleeing political situations in their homelands, and some also enter the U.S. without the proper paperwork. If they're caught crossing the border or coming off an airplane from another continent, they're detained by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. A Washington Post investigation found many of the detainees had poor or substandard medical care. Some were getting medication they didn't need, and others needed medication and didn't get it. 83 died. Dana Priest co-wrote the Washington Post series. The four-part series on the medical care of detainees was published in the Post this May and also had companion online pieces. Joining Dana is lawyer Ann Schofield Baker. She is the attorney for Amina Moody, a former detainee from Somalia who was heavily drugged against her will and suffered side effects from the medication. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
So, Dana, how did you and the Post first get wind that this would be a story worth pursuing?
Well, it was a little unusual for me. I've been here for 23 years, and I've never had access to the type of documentation that we eventually got access to that enabled us to do this story, the series. We had really an amazing treasure trove that allowed us to look inside this particular agency called the Division of Immigration Health Services, which is a part of ICE and is responsible for the medical care of what is about 33,000 detainees on any given day in these facilities. And so we had all these autopsies and medical records, investigative reports, internal ones, emails, memos, and we spent months and months sifting through all of them, trying to figure out where the patterns are, what does this mean? And it gave us a look into a very secretive, and I don't mean that in a, you know, it's not classified or anything, but it's a very withheld world, and that's intentional. And like many things that don't have the sunshine of public opinion shining on them, bad things were happening. So after 9/11, when it was decided that immigration would be a national security issue and that the policy would be to pick up many more people that were potentially eligible for deportation, the ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement Agency, set out and did that and gathered triple the number of people this year than 2000. But their budget never increased, and the organization was very dysfunctional.
Well, let's get to the story of Amina Moody. She's from Somalia, arrived in New York last year seeking political asylum, and she couldn't be with us today, but the Washington Post online videotaped her, and here's a little bit of her telling her story.
I'm come from Somalia. I'm coming to America because Somalia, the life is no good. Then you kill my father and my two brother and my sister.
And you represented Miss Moody. Tell us briefly about her story and how you got involved in her case.
Sure. Well, first, I got involved in her case through an organization called Human Rights First, which is an organization that pairs up top lawyers from firms here in New York and around the country with people who are seeking asylum and who are worthy of seeking asylum in their opinion. I'm actually an intellectual property litigator. In fact, this was the first asylum case I had ever taken. But Amina's case was a very good one. She came from Somalia where she suffered unspeakable torture and abuse and loss in that country. And she had a number of family members who were murdered, and it was just a terrible story. She escaped and came to the United States in April of 2007, and she sought asylum, but was incarcerated at the Elizabeth Detention Center in New Jersey upon her arrival.
Now, tell us about the medication she was given and what kinds of side effects came out of that.
When Amina first arrived at the detention center, she had a panic attack and fainted. Now, she didn't speak English at the time, and the DIHS medical staff examined her without an interpreter. For example, they wrote in her notes that in her records that she has epilepsy and that she has seizures once or twice a week for 5 years. And when I asked Amina about it later, she said, "I don't have epilepsy. I was trying to tell them that I have headaches once or twice a week for the last 5 years." Well, the medical staff completely misdiagnosed her as being psychotic and placed her on a very powerful antipsychotic drug called Risperdal that caused devastating and actually potentially life-threatening side effects. She started to lactate and drool. She started to convulse uncontrollably, and her tongue thrust around in her mouth involuntarily. There's a whole host of other symptoms that she experienced as well. And she actually also appeared as though she was mentally disabled when, in fact, developmentally disabled when, in fact, she's highly intelligent.
How good was her English at the time?
She didn't speak any English.
She didn't speak any.
No, and actually, as soon as I came into the case, I brought an interpreter with me for every visit that I had with Amina because I couldn't communicate with her otherwise. And when I realized that there was such a disconnect between the care she was getting, they just couldn't understand each other. So I offered on numerous occasions in written form to have the detention center doctors use my interpreter or an interpreter that I would pay for, and I gave them the phone number of an interpreter and said, please call this woman whenever you want to render medical care to my client. I don't even need to be on the phone, and I'll pay for it. And they never did it.
Dana, I read the series, and you have some very different examples within the series, but how typical is the lack of communication as a factor in these medical cases?
Well, it seems to be the rule instead of the exception. If you don't speak English, and you're lucky to speak Spanish because they have more interpreters who speak Spanish, but if you're from an African country where they don't speak Spanish and you don't speak English well, forget it. You know, they don't have interpreters. One person described it to us as playing charades with a foreigner. You know, you cannot communicate. You're pointing to your head or your heart or this sort of thing, and people are very frightened when they come in, so they're hard to often to talk to anyway. On top of that, I would say, is a lack of legal representation. You know, Anne is an exception, too, in that she was put together with Amina, and there are so few lawyers and immigrants who can meet up because it's difficult. They make it hard for people to do that.
Now, this week, an internal review by Homeland Security was given to the press, and that agency investigated a couple of cases from 2006 in which detainees died. They said the government wasn't negligent, but could have done a better job. Dana, what do you think about that report?
Well, we had that report 2 months ago when it was in its draft form, and some of it appears in the series. They pretty much exonerated ICE from the two deaths, but they pointed out, and I don't have it in front of me, so this is just from memory, that ICE's oversight was lacking, that ICE said that it had set up some inspection groups, but that those were really in its infancy. They also inspected some files and found that they were way out of whack, that there were many that hadn't been done in the period of time that they were supposed to be done, and that really matters when you're talking about medical care. You need to get people in and examine them, and if there's a problem that's identified, you need to treat it, or it will get worse under those circumstances, or, you know, perhaps spread to other people. Many cases of doctors and nurses and other healthcare providers worrying that the staff shortages are making it difficult to do the exams, and that a very dysfunctional computer system that was put in place after millions was spent to create an electronic medical record system wasn't working. In fact, it was losing records or chewing up records, and people were very frustrated with this. Everyone knew that it was a problem, and yet the management was not fixing it quick enough.
And how is Ms. Mude doing now?
She is doing so well, I'm happy to report. She is in English classes full-time. She is also learning computers. Her English skills now are really quite remarkable for someone who came to the country such a short time ago and who spoke no English when she got here. She is just thrilled to be here. And the only real issue that she has is really just one of financing, because she you know, doesn't, I mean, actually, partially because I'm guiding her. I really don't want her to get a job full time right now, so she can focus on her English and her classes. But she is living off of the funds that we have given her from a trust account that my law firm set up for her. And but other than, you know, needing a little bit more money, she's doing just great.
Well, I'm so glad we got a chance to talk with both of you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dana Priest is a Washington Post reporter. She worked on a four-part series on health care at U.S. immigration detention centers, and she joined us from the studios at the Washington Post. We also spoke with Ann Schofield Baker. She's an attorney who represented Amina Mude, a former immigration detainee from Somalia. Ms. Mude now has asylum in the United States.